We're going to do something special for this one. Hey, Grant, come on over here. Say hi, buddy.
Hey there. Welcome to the Smart Simple Matters show with your host, Joe Sidlowski. This is episode number 55.
Thank you for listening in. My 3.5-year-old son, Grant, has returned the podcasting microphone to me for now, but he has another special message for you at the end of the show, so don't miss that. I'll make sure his younger brother, Clark, gets a shot at rocking the podcasting scene too when he's a bit older than 11 months. Now, on to another fella with a snappy one-syllable name. I want to give a shout out to Chris for this recent Smart and Simple Matters review he left on iTunes. Chris's review title was "The Relatable Authentic Voice of Simplicity," and here's what he wrote. Joel delivers incredible value in every podcast. Every time I listen, I get something new to put into my mental toolbox. Not only that, but Joel has a great sense of humor and never lets his episodes bog down into overly serious instructional lectures. His wit and wisdom from his own life stories illuminate great efficiencies and philosophies for people in every walk of life. End of review. Whew. Well, a major hat tip to you, Chris, for saying such nice words about me and the show. I'll keep featuring the reviews as long as groovy listeners like you keep leaving them. I like to think it's a virtuous cycle. Well, we are hot on the heels of a bonus Smart and Simple Matters episode last week when I recap my 2014 World Domination Summit experience. I have been getting a ton of great feedback on that episode, which you can find at valueofsimple.com/SASM054. And I'm glad it turned out to be a valuable instead of a self-congratulatory episode. Wasn't really sure which way it was going to go, but you dig it and I love it. I don't have any major personal events to share with you this time around, so what do you say? Let's get into the heart of this episode with Cecile Andrews. Now, I first connected with Cecile when Vicky Robin, who was featured in SASM episode 52, helped me coordinate a simple living-themed conversation with some truly amazing people. Although you didn't get to hear much from Cecile in episode 52, she is just so dang awesome that I wanted to bring her back for a dedicated conversation, just the two of us. Now, we're going to go beyond her father's death and how that transformed her life when she was 8. Because Cecile is going to explain the 4 C's of happiness, how she got labeled a hedonist of the simplicity movement, the one book that changed everything for her when she was growing up, why she believes that any topic will bring you back to simplicity, and why we're both going to stand in the longest grocery store line from now on. You ready to do this? My buddy Grant over here is ready to do this. So here we go. My guest today is a woman who I stumbled into by going down a long rabbit hole. Her name is Cecile Andrews, and she's a community educator giving classes, workshops, and forming study circles on community building and the new simplicity. She's been featured in lots of places like CBS, NPR, PBS, and many other prominent places for decades of work on some of the most important issues of our time. And she's written a number of acclaimed books like Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, A Caring Economy and Lasting Happiness, and most recently, one titled Living Room Revolution. Now, she's in Seattle right now for the summer, but Cecile lives in Santa Cruz, California for the rest of the time as a member of the Walnut Commons co-housing group. Welcome to the show, Cecile. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start where I normally start, which is with something I call the seeds of awesomeness. Could you explain for people who are unfamiliar with you one or two things about your environment growing up, or maybe even one or two experiences that help us understand why you are the person that you are today?
Well, this is kind of a strange example to give, but when I was 8 years old, my father died in an airplane crash. Now, that doesn't sound very positive, but what it did to me is it said, you know, you got to take your life seriously. You don't know how long you're going to be around. You've got to do what you feel is important. You've got to do what makes you happy. And it's kind of like, you know, so many of us just kind of go through life doing what we're supposed to do and discover maybe that didn't work because you didn't really take it seriously. So the theme that emerged the most to me was the theme of how do we live more simply? Because to me, simplicity isn't just, okay, cutting back here, cutting back there, getting rid of stuff. It's really the examined life. It's asking yourself, you know, how do I live? Making conscious choices about things that affect the well-being of people in the planet. So that early experience with my father said, okay, you know, you just can't follow the regular path. You've got to take your life seriously. And the idea of simplicity was the thing that brought all this together. And so it's an incredibly complex idea that was introduced to me in a very simple way. And then I had one other, because I think it's interesting. I was just talking about this the other day, that, you know, what made me a progressive? What made me a liberal?
Yeah, by
and
all means.
This also had to do with my father. My father's family, this was in Oklahoma, it was Pentecostal. So, you know, I knew I wasn't a Pentecostal, but my father's family wanted to take me to church. And so they said, okay, you can take her to church. But somehow I knew it wasn't me. But one morning in church, I got feeling sick. And so I told my grandmother, and my grandmother took me up into the front of the church, and all these men came up and put their hands on my head and started praying that I would get better. Well, then they stopped and asked me, how did I feel? Well, I felt horrible, of course. But I didn't want to hurt their feelings. I wanted to be polite. I also worried that if I didn't tell them the truth, I'd be lying in church. And what were the repercussions of that? Right. So I always like to ask my friends, what do they think I did? Did I lie or tell the truth? Well, I lied. I said, I'm feeling much better. Thank you very much. Because, of course, I knew that they would keep on if I said I wasn't feeling better and I wanted them to stop. So I went home, and first of all, I was diagnosed with the measles, so they most likely were exposed to the measles. But it said a couple of things to me. One, first of all, nothing happened to me because I lied in church, and so it kind of said, okay, you don't have to worry about being a traditional person who doesn't lie in church. But the other thing it said to me is that these men who were in charge didn't necessarily know what they were doing. And so it kind of released me from, you know, the conventional authorities. Because they obviously didn't know what would really work. So those two things, I think, really affected me and, you know, have encouraged me to keep, like, questioning things and trying to think things through for myself, which is, of course, what the study circles are all about.
Yeah. Well,
so those are my two things.
That's a really early part in your life to have that kind of self-awareness. And come to that realization. I didn't have these kinds of thoughts that you're describing until my 20s, where I started thinking, you know, for me, as somebody who was born and raised very Jewish, and now I'm an atheist, I didn't start questioning authority and the path, as you mentioned it, you know, what I'm supposed to do. I knew what I was supposed to do, and that's what I did. And I didn't really challenge anyone or anything until much later in my life, and I struggled mightily as a result of it. Now, I'm sure you had your challenges, so maybe even bigger or different than mine, because you came to this realization a little bit earlier than I did. So, you know, we'll get into a whole bunch of great stuff, but how did that impact everyone else around you when they saw you marching to your own drummer?
Well, basically, what it said to me was, you're supposed to be enjoying your life. And I think all the messages most of us got was, and I did this too, you know, worked hard and did well in school and things like that. But I think I became the hedonist of the simplicity movement, because I knew that the most important thing was you're supposed to be enjoying yourself. And so what that did, and this is interesting what it did to the people around me, I noticed one day, and this was like when I was an adult, that whenever people wanted to get out of something, they would call me up. And they'd say, you know, I got asked to be on this board, and I think it'll be important for my career. And but, you know, I'm not really sure. I think I should do it, but I really am not sure I want to do it. And so I would say to them, well, tell them no. You don't have to do it. And somebody else would call me, and, you know, they get a new job offer, and I'd say, if you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it. And so I realized that I thought, my goodness, why are they calling me? Do I have a reputation being a shirker? And then I thought, you know, but then I realized that all my life I had gotten out of things that I didn't want to do. You know, started in campfire. I didn't want to be in campfire, so I dropped out, where everybody said, oh, you've got to stay in. When I was in graduate school, I talked my way out of statistics. And then when I was an administrator in a community college, I eventually decided, no, that's not what I want to be. I'd rather freelance and write and teach. So I had this, and I really do think it was a gift from my father, this, like, you know, you're supposed to be enjoying yourself. And so that's where I, again, came to simplicity, because I could see all this other stuff wasn't making Americans happy. Mm-hmm. And so there must be another path. And then I also read Little Women and Louisa May Alcott. So this, and boys don't do that when they're little. And that probably is why they're farther behind, as you describe your development in your 20s. If you would have read Little Women, you would have questioned things earlier. But so I think that what people began to see is I became a very non-threatening, non-judgmental person, really easy for people to be around. And so because I wasn't expecting them, I don't think I competed with them as we're taught to do. I don't think I was saying you should be this way. I think it made me a pretty, you know, again, a person say, yeah, you know, this is good enough. Yeah, let's enjoy ourselves. That's the important thing. So I think that that's essentially what it did to me. Did make me into a shirker, but a nice shirker people like to be around.
I've never heard somebody describe himself as a hedonist of the simplicity movement. And that kind of counters the traditional view that a lot of people have, which is that simple living, slowing down, opting out of mainstream culture and the wants and needs that the vast majority of people have is viewed upon as self-deprivation. And you've talked a bit about this in your books, in interviews that I've watched. You view simplicity, you already mentioned it, the examined life, living deliberately. So what do you say to counter this view that the simple path is one of self-deprivation?
Well, and I'm always shocked because people will say, you know, what's that thing you're involved in, that self-deprivation movement? And so my other favorite story is I thought, okay, what am I going to do about this? And one day I had a young man who was at our house, and he was looking at the stuff on my refrigerator where I had my grocery list that I just started. And he looked at it and he said, whoa, he said, you really walk your talk. And I said, what? And I came over and on it said bread and water. And I said, no, this is not my week's rations. Those are what I have to get to go to a party. And I thought, how do we get away from this view? And so I started thinking about it, and I saw a quote from Saint-Exupéry, the guy who did The Little Prince, and he said, if you want someone to build you a boat, you don't give them the tools and the wood, and, you know, what you do is you teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And I thought, whoa, that's it. Teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. It's, you've got to give people a vision of what they want. And what we were doing in simplicity is kind of an anti-vision that didn't lure people, that didn't seduce people, that we had to give them one that would seduce them. And so I thought, what would that be? And the thing that came to me, and it was kind of the beginning of the slow food movement, I think slow food movement hasn't gone in the right direction in this country, but what slow food was talking about, and you had to listen to it because it, you know, it spread around the world, the whole slow food idea. What it was talking about was people coming together, enjoying themselves, eating stuff that was good for them, that was good for the planet. And I thought, this is a vision. It's a vision of the joyful community, of people coming together, of them connecting with the earth, and that this sense of connection and joyfulness and community. And so I thought, wow, that is the vision. If we get people to work toward a joyful community, they don't want to go shopping anymore. You know, they're not concerned about being the top in their careers. They're concerned about connecting with other people, connecting with the earth, and so they're not going to, you know, abuse either one in the ways that we do. And in fact, there is research that shows that when you have a culture that has a lot of places for people to gather, you know, cafes and pubs and public squares and outdoor, you know, places to sit, that they don't shop as much. It reduces their consumerism. And that makes sense because, you know, they have something more positive to do than go to the mall. And they don't have to compete and impress anybody because they've got their friends and family right there. And so I began to see and I began to ask, how can we create this vision? What can we do to give people this experience of a joyful community? And so that has been my calling, to figure out how to do that and to bring people together.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people. I've seen a lot of people do this successfully, where instead of just warning somebody and issuing these dire threats about all these bad things that are going to happen to you if you don't do this, inviting them to something different, to something potentially more fulfilling, turning away from the things that over and over they just have not delivered in the ways that are that deep, you know, that resonate inside of us. And I've seen you say it before, and you talk about connection and community, which I'm huge on too, but trying to create this culture where we feel like we're intertwined, we're together, not individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, yes, we mm-hmm. all exist as individuals at some point in time, viewing ourselves as something greater than us, an individual,
mm-hmm.
which kind of gets into a little bit of what you're doing right now. And I know you're not a huge fan of the name, and I struggle with terminology and semantics and language too, but this seems like a really good time to ask you, what is a simplicity circle?
Well, this, first of all, to me, this is just like, you know, one of the tools for social change, and it's been used a lot. Let's take this through history. I mean, you can start with Socrates. What did he do? He engaged people in conversation. And essentially, a simplicity circle, I think of it as it's a conversation that we bring people together. And then you can look at the French Revolution. You know, they had the salons and the Chautauqua movement in this country, and then modern movement, the women's consciousness raising. But the biggest thing that really, really brought me to this was in the 60s, after college, I went down to the South and worked with the American Friends Service Committee, the Quaker organization, and I worked in the Black South and in the Civil Rights Movement, and they took me to a place that changed my life. I mean, we can't say that about many things, but this did, and some people have heard of Highlander Center, and Highlander was where Rosa Parks was trained, and Highlander was really the secret of the Civil Rights Movement, because what it did... And Martin Luther King was there, Eleanor Roosevelt was there, Pete Seeger was there. They're the ones who kind of unearthed the song, We Shall Overcome. And what they did was they brought people together to talk, and they would find the answers. Miles Horton, the director, had this vision always, what can I do to change? And he went and he discovered this in Denmark in the folk schools. And he had this vision, you bring people together, and not with experts, but they will talk and find the answer. Then they go out, and this is always part of it. It's not just talking. They go out and try the things that they've talked about, and then they come back and they talk again. Mm-hmm. So it's back and forth. And so I had always planned to be an educator, but of course the kind of educator that got up in front and kind of spouted what I knew and tested people on it and graded people. And I realized, no, that doesn't change people. It doesn't change the world. And so I went back and worked in a community college where I created a lot of these study circles, and they became something that I could see really change people's lives. And so when I did Circle of Simplicity, my first book, it was about how you do these simplicity circles and that anybody could do them. You didn't have to be trained, because all you had to do is come together, and I kind of gave an outline so they had something to follow. But first you talk about your personal experience, and this is so important. We don't do this usually in college or any regular school classes.
Okay, so now we get into the how-to. All right, so step one is get a group of, how many people do you recommend? four, six people?
Six to eight. Best size.
So you get six to eight people. Some of them are friends. Maybe some of them are friends of friends, or maybe even strangers who you just seem a little bit fascinated by. You know, somebody who wants to start one of these, you just invite people to a cafe over to your house. Does it matter where you meet or whether there's food?
You can do whatever you want. And so I often have done these through organizations. So I might do them through the community college, which gets the word out, or I might do them through a church group, which gets the word out. So it's easier, but if you can bring people together on your own, that's just great. And it can be whatever is comfortable for you, and it can be at home, and of course food is always nice, but I'm totally lazy. Oh, besides being a shirker and a hedonist, I am also totally lazy. So after a while, I even gave up making people tea, and I just said, here are the tea things. If you want it, you make it.
Okay.
So very, very low standards. But one thing about having low standards is when I do something and I have some group or do something, everybody else thinks, oh, wow, if she could do it, I could do it. You know, she's not really putting much effort into this at all. And so it makes it more doable for other people. And it's interesting because I think any subject matter will bring us back to simplicity. And so I will do a group on building community. I did a group on current events. These are over the years. I do all sorts of groups, but eventually they bring us back to simplicity because they're all asking, what are our essential values? You know, what do we need to do for the well-being of people on the planet? And it always comes back to people, you know, consuming less, people slowing down, people building community, people reflecting on their lives and living consciously. So you start out and you bring people together. So yes, that's the start, bring people together.
Okay,
so
bring people together, prerequisite for pretty much everything that's good that happens,
right,
that's positive,
right,
in the world.
Right.
So step two, talk about your experiences. Step three, I think you're starting to get into this a little bit, is that experimenting with what you discuss in these simplicity study circles?
Okay. So the basic bringing people together, that's not step one. Step one is, that's just there. Step one really is start out with a question that people answer from their own life experience. So I might say to them, when in your life have you experienced community? Everyone, so you go around the circle. This is the other important thing. So part of this I'm giving you the three steps, and part of it I'm giving you the process of it. You go around the circle, and everybody tells their little story, and you get people to limit to 3 minutes. Sometimes you can have a little timer, you can do it, because that's important, because it's hard to control people who go on and on. Anyway, so they tell their story, and then the second one, and this is the important part as well, you ask, well, what is it in our community that keeps us from enjoying community? Now, the reason this is important is because we want people to start with the personal, to kind of root it in their own thoughts and ideas, but we want them to move beyond and be questioning the larger society. We want them to be critical thinkers. We want them to be thinking consciously. And this is really, I think, the key to getting people to change their minds on things. You say, what in our experience in this culture keeps us from having community? Well, people will come up again from their own experience, because that's what they know, and that helps them. But they can also use their research that they've read. But people will come up with saying, well, we're always rushing around. Well, then you, as the organizer, can say, well, you're right. You know, there's a lot of research that shows that we rush around, that we don't take time, we don't take vacations, you know, we work too many hours. So somebody else can bring that up, but it's rooted in the critique of the culture. So then the third thing is, well, what could you do to create more community? Now, in this case, you have two things. One, what can you do in your own personal life? And so maybe it's, okay, I'm going to invite some people over for dinner. The second thing is, what can you do in the wider culture? And maybe you're going to say, well, I'm going to sign up and work with, you know, Mothers Against Gun Violence, that I'm going to do something that affects the wider culture. And so this to me is what's the real key to this, that it's not just a support group for people to change their own lives. It really is a support group to help them change the culture as well as their own lives. So then what you do is you go home that week and you try, you have people over for dinner. You do something, maybe say you're going to borrow a cup of sugar. You do that. And then you come back and you start that week out telling the story from the last week. You can say, okay, this is what happened. I went over and I borrowed sugar from my neighbor. And they looked at me like, and they said, we don't have sugar in this house. Like, it was totally unsuccessful. You totally failed. Well, what you do is you analyze that with everybody. And so you analyze your actions. So you learn something. And it may have gone really well. And you analyze that, too. Well, why did it work? And the other thing, the cultural change, the cultural step, is a longer term. You say, well, you know, I looked up and I found the website for Mothers Against Gun Violence. And they have a meeting next week. I think I'll go. So the key is linking the personal with the public policy issues, linking the personal with the political. And when you do that, it affects both. You feel better because you're taking immediate action in your own life, but then you feel like you're making a difference in the larger culture. And that gives you a real sense of satisfaction, which then, you know, helps you make other changes.
Absolutely.
So that's essentially the study circle. Now, there's lots of different kinds.
I'm going to link in the show notes to this episode for more if people want some of the how-to. I think you've already given us a pretty good one. Just if I can recap it to make sure I have it right, because I'm pretty intrigued. I think I'm going to be starting one here in the next couple of weeks. So getting people together, of course, going around the circle with a timer, having people answer a prompt like, when have you experienced community? That was the example you gave. So you critique in general what the culture says or what your experience has been. And then the third part is, what can you do in your own life and in the wider culture to impact people, to create change? Step four, go home, experiment, report back to your group. And then the fifth part is you're analyzing your thoughts and actions with the group. And then it's this continuous process.
Yes, and there's one other important thing. When I said that these are conversations, they are not discussions. This is supposed to be enjoyable conversation. We're not supposed to get into arguments. There's a book that I've used by Deborah Tannen called The Argument Society, and says that's what America has become, and most people now are afraid to give their opinions because they're afraid somebody's going to jump on them. And this doesn't matter if it's just between the left and right. You know, I consider myself very much to the left. But when I'm in the left in groups, the arguments are almost always there, and they're essentially sometimes accusing you of not being left enough. So this is meant to be a barn raising, not a battle, that you are helping each other build something new. You are not tearing things down. And this goes along with the fact that we need a vision of something that it fulfills us instead of always talking about what's wrong with everything. So I don't believe anymore, if I'm standing up in front of a big group, I will certainly argue from my point of view. But when I'm with people face to face, I don't argue. I listen, I will state my point of view, but I won't try to pressure them into it. And some people know the Jewish theologian of many years ago, Martin Buber, who talked about the I thou instead of the I it. That people can never be treated as subjects or as objects. They must be treated as subjects. So this is, again, the phrase barn raising, not a battle, is very important to me in how we do these. You should go home feeling just great.
All right, well, you talked a bit about your vision and inviting people into something different. And one of the challenges that I've had, at least with all the projects that I've been involved in, is describing it, the specific language that you've used. And you've admitted yourself, simplicity seems like something that doesn't really hit home with people anymore. Although my experience has been, it does, at least simple living is still a topic that is front and center in a lot of people's minds. But study circles, nothing very sexy about that. What language have you been using lately that you feel is getting through to people and really communicating well the vision of where you are helping everyone else go?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that simple living and you know, there has always been a simple living movement in this country. First of all, simple living is an age-old idea all the way through history. People have talked about the ideas of simplicity. And it's been particularly true in this country because we did start out one with the Quakers and one with the Puritans, but we started out with a lot of wealth. And whenever a lot of wealth is generated, there's usually some wise people who come and say, no, that's not what this life is about. So there's always been a simplicity movement, and so it seems to have cycled through. So maybe what's happening is this is going to be something that's very appealing to young people, whether or not they know that it's been around for, you know, a long time. The person who influenced me was Thoreau the most, and so, you know, that was probably he's probably the best spokesperson for simple living. And there he was in the 1860s and earlier. So I've talked about joyful community because even with the study circle, you know, nobody likes the word study, which again, I think reflects poorly on this country. People don't mind the word, you know, we don't want to think of studying, but people don't mind the word circle, but sometimes I feel like it has kind of a, you know, wishy-washy connotation, the word circle. And so I've thought of it as community education. I thought of it as, you know, people's education, people's learning. But none of those, and so I really haven't come up with something. And so I'm always interested in what other people think. But essentially, it's people coming together, talking about important things, reflecting, and choosing this life that is beneficial to people and the planet, which usually comes out to mean we're going to live more simply. But what's happened, the other word that some people are using, and this sounds strange again, but, you know, we've got the happiness movement. And when it first started coming out, that kind of got people's attention. But I think that's starting to die, too. And there's something about this country, this is not a surprise, you know, we want to move on to the new thing, and we get bored with the old ones. But the thing about the happiness movement and the research that's being done is it's helped us in the simple living movement, because essentially it says, you know, and I've kind of reduced it to four C's. What you need to be happy, first of all, you need connection to other people. Then you need calling. Then you need control. And then you need celebration. Those are the four elements of happiness. Now, this sounds, the control one sounds kind of strange, because we think of people, you know, uptight and, you know, really rigid, and they need to chill a little and they need to let go a little. But what control really means is that to be happy, you need control over your life. You need to feel you're not out of control. So this helps us talk about politics. You know, the person who feels they have no way to influence politics feels out of control of their lives. So this is why democracy is so important. Simple living is part of this, because when you're living more simply, you are in control. You're not spending your money on any old thing that's not good for you, going into debt. You're consciously choosing. So simplicity fits under this. But also what fits under this is the study circle idea, because you're coming together to make conscious choices, and you're helping each other out to make these choices. And whenever you have other people to help you out, you always feel in more control. So
and in a joyful
movement.
Way. I'm sure anyone who's in your simplicity study circle is having a joyful, jubilant time, because that's just the kind of person you are. And I'm sure that's the kind of environment that you bring around wherever it is that you go. That's a big part of it, too. Tell me about some other things, though, in your local community in Seattle. I know that you've been involved, you know, bringing people together and the sense of community. There's something that I'm just starting to get aware of. You talk about things that are maybe on the wane, simplicity, the happiness movement. But one thing that I see is bubbling up now and getting more traction is this thing called transition towns. You've been involved, right? Can you explain that to people?
Well, it's interesting, because transition towns, I found totally exciting. First of all, there was this concept of an eco-village, and we kind of, in my neighborhood in Seattle, we formed what we called Finney Eco-Village. Finney's the name of the neighborhood. And essentially, it's simplicity, but it's in a different way, because they also want to affect the local town government. And so, but you will go to your local city council, and you'll talk to them about what they can do to build policies in the town. Now, it's interesting, because in in England, they did start out in towns, but now it's spread to London. It's spread to cities around the world.
It's a misnomer in a way. Town is just, it's as you said, it's started in a town, but it can be a city. You could have a transition state. Maybe even someday there'll be a transition country. I think Bhutan is probably the closest thing that's happening. I'm keeping an eager eye on what they're doing there. You know, they were the gross national happiness, and you talked about happiness too, which I am just very interested in how they pursue that. They've recently declared that everything will be organic. They will grow only organic produce in Bhutan.
Wow.
And I think they are as close to a transition country as any would do. But from my understanding, food growing groups and community-owned businesses that produce their own food, that produce their own energy, mostly through renewables and maybe even locally shared energy, all these different initiatives, to me, they seem different from other environmental or sustainable initiatives because it's homegrown. It's a lot of community-led education and action. There's a lot of different stakeholders that are all coming together to have these conversations to figure out how can we be self-reliant at the local level? How can we increase our resiliency? And those are something that I think anybody can get behind, whether they're a Simple Living advocate or not.
Exactly. And I forgot to mention in the beginning, it's called transition because it's how do we transition to a society that doesn't use much oil, you know, and there's the peak oil movement, which kind of scares people. And so, you know, if you go on and read peak oil stuff, it's like, don't do this, be careful of this, and kind of dire threats, which are legitimate. But the transition says, come together, you know, form your own co-op, form your own group that helps each other, and it somehow does the same thing, but with this positive feeling. And part of the transition movement, and you're probably going to ask about this right away anyway, is the sharing movement. And, you know, there's a wonderful website. Well, it's really an online magazine, shareable.net. And the whole sharing movement is just kind of like just burgeoning. It's just bubbling out. And that might be the one thing that is not, that I haven't seen, you know, as I say, in Santa Cruz, the transition movement kind of died out, the transition group. And I've heard of that happening in some other places. But the sharing idea of coming together and figuring out, you know, like people living together, I would say going into the co-housing that I am, is a part of the sharing movement. That don't do just things alone. We've got to work together. And that the word together is such an important word. So sharing, I think, is in the center of transition as well.
Absolutely. And
but
if
really
people want more,
exciting.
I just recently had a podcast episode. It's episode 51. It'll be in the show notes along with a link to shareable.net and everything else we've talked about. Lauren Anderson, an Australian woman who's doing amazing things with collaborative consumption, which is synonymous with the share economy, whether it's with cars or housing or tools. We have so much, and mostly it's not do we have enough? It's how do we distribute the excess that we already possess? How can we collaborate better? And all of these startups, I'm not much into the startup scene, but whenever I get a whiff of some new share economy service or product that is now in my community here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I want to test it out because I know, one, it might save me money, it might save me time, but two, I'm going to get to know my community better and I'm going to get to share what I have with them. And that always excites the heck out of me. And it also helps me just lead a more deliberate life, a more intentional life. As I engage more people, it's not just a, hey, here's my chainsaw, see you later. I'm having a conversation with somebody. I'm figuring out, why are you doing this? You know, what's the reason behind us exchanging reputation and trust together? Do you also live slowly? Like, do you desire to slow down and not just try to have and own one of everything or more? And that's one other thing that I want to talk to you about. One of the reasons I was really excited to have you on. We've talked about simple living. We've talked about transition towns, the share economy, and all these different things. But there's this concept, too, of living slowly. And I know that's something that you've been practicing for a while. Can you tell us, what does that mean to you to live slow?
So it means, again, it has to do with deliberation that you're thinking through. But more than that, it's like, you know, a lot of people talk about mindfulness. It's going at the pace where you can really enjoy your life. That you're just, you know, you're not rushing through your day. You're going slow enough. Even physically moving more slowly. Even talking more slowly. So there is the aspect, the real physical aspect to it. But essentially that you, your day, that you're really connecting with things. That you're really talking to that person. Your mind is in somebody place else. You're really enjoying looking at the, you know, I live close to a little lake in Seattle, and when I walk around that lake, I don't want my head just lost in thought. I want to be enjoying the lake. I want to be enjoying seeing the people, and you're conscious that, you know, the sun is coming down, coming out, and so it's really this, like, this is it. You know, this is it. It's today. I'm going to enjoy today. I'm not going to just put off, you know, for everything else that I should be doing, I should be getting done. I'm going to make sure that I enjoy each moment. So it has to do then when you start thinking with a lot of different things, like take slow parenting. You know, it doesn't say, okay, you know, let's get you ready for your daycare thing. Let's get you out for your lessons today. Let's take you this way, that way.
Yeah, boom, no, whip out the door here and there, shuttling back and forth. You know, I'm a father. I have two small boys, and they're not in extracurricular activities yet. But I'm also very conscious of the fact that there will be a push from society and from their friends to get them to do a whole bunch of stuff, to be and to experience a whole bunch of things. And a lot of it is just busyness that isn't adding a lot of value to them. So this concept of slow parenting.
But you're going to get the pressure from your culture because you're going to, as an aside, when I had a friend once who saw me starting yet another small group, and she said, oh, Cecile, you're doing it again. You must have been a sheepdog in a former life. And I thought, yes, indeed, I was a sheepdog.
I'm starting to feel that way too, Cecile.
But see, now I'm no longer a sheepdog because it goes around yapping at people's heels. Now I am a Bichon, which is a little dog that likes to hang out with people. So that's my essential change of character. But anyway, a slow education would be having people sit and having leisurely conversations in the classroom, having them go out and walk around the lake and come back and report on what they saw in nature.
And maybe I can't even remember the name. Without direction or without some kind of time constraint, just wandering. And being in awe of the nature that's around us. I see people doing slow in a lot of different ways, like taking an hour to eat lunch without doing something else at the same time. I know it's revolutionary for a lot of people to just simply eat and savor the heck out of your food. Like, why would I want to just eat? I could be doing three other things. I could be driving. I could be listening to a podcast. I could be reading a blog post. But that's, to a lot of people, it's like, wait, I just need to slow down and just take an hour to eat and to really think about this food and everything that it took to get it on my plate. Meditation. Exactly. And I love the examples that you give. I was in preparation for our chat, I was listening to a couple of interviews, and you talked about the closed door button on an elevator and how this one time you were just pounding that button over and over again, like, close door, close. As if you couldn't wait two or three extra seconds for that door to close on its own. And then you also mentioned, I want to make sure people hear this, picking the line in a grocery store where people look the most fascinating and engaging, not the one that is going to lead to the fastest checkout. I tell you, Cecile, every time I get into a grocery store line from now on, I am going to pick the line. And as an extrovert, I certainly don't mind doing it. People might mind me trying to strike up a conversation. Like, who are you, random dude who's trying to talk to me? But I really like that concept of just not being in a rush, engaging fully with your environment, whether that's nature or people or food or whatever it is that's in front of you. I really like that concept.
Exactly.
And whatever people can do to be more slow, to live more slowly. I've had a tremendous amount of success in the last 4 years since my personal renaissance began. It just slowing the heck down. And it's made a world of difference for my family, for my community, and for my ability to make an impact.
Yes. And particularly with the way, you know, you relate to people, you know, it really makes a difference when people feel appreciated and noticed, and that somebody's paid attention and somebody's really engaged. And So one of the big things that I really recommend people is, you know, when you're out walking, that you say hello to everybody. That I always talk about stop and chats, because that came from Larry David, who did Curb Your Enthusiasm, because he hates stop and chats. You know, he'll go across the street when he sees somebody he knows. But if you're taking your time, you stop and you chat, and you have time for these people, and people go away, honest to God, they do, they go away transformed. They feel so much better because they've engaged with somebody else, and you've smiled, and you've talked about nothing. Sometimes you might have very serious, in just 2 or 3 minutes, you might have very serious conversations. I had one man tell me when I stopped with my little Bichon, and he had his Bichon, he told me that his little dog had taught him the meaning of love. And I thought, oh, what a wonderful, wonderful conversation to have him say that. But we don't get it. If we're rushing, we're not going to do that. So, yes, the slowing down is, I think of it as, I can't remember what I said, something lives of wonder. Oh, I know what it was, sustainable lives of wonder. That's what you get for the word slow. So that's a good acronym.
Well, we've covered a lot of history here and a lot of different movements. But as far as you're concerned, if you could go back and start over with your journey into simplicity and trying to help people in these small groups and forming community, is there something specific that you would do differently if you could?
I would put this connection with the other person at the absolute top. And, you know, when you do that, when people experience being cared for, they are able to care. And if they can care for their own species, maybe they will care for the rest of the species. Mm-hmm. That it has to start with caring. And as my role in life is, how do I create these situations of caring for people? And usually for me, it's a study circle, but it might be having people over for an ice cream social. It might be this as I walk through the day and stop and talk to people. So whenever we can create that feeling and that experience of caring, it also saves the planet. But it does it by helping people change themselves and to feel, you know, more caring and loving and excited and exuberant and joyful. And so it's working toward that joyful community. That would be what I didn't do in the beginning. And that's what I would do now, or am doing now. So,
yeah, isn't it interesting when you take a non-human-centric approach to things? We as humans are incredibly, and our social norms of society encourages us to connect with other humans. You and I are doing it right now. We're saying, build community, interact with other people. But when you take a step back and you think that we are one of millions of species on this planet, and by just focusing so intently on us as individuals or as a group, that often we neglect everything else, which is the vast, vast majority of the world. So I like the way that you framed it. Is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you would like people to know?
No, except this was wonderful. I think what you're doing is just great. You know, I mean, again, anytime you can create conversation, and you're doing the public a favor. In fact, Putnam from Bowling Alone says that the people who talk over their back fence are the people who vote. And that John Dewey said, democracy begins in conversation. And so this is relevant to everything that's coming together and talking with people. So what you're doing is really, really important. And so I'm glad I got to do it with you.
Well, great. I have a huge smile right now. I may even be blushing. I'll have to look in a mirror, because when I blush, it sticks around for a long time. Well, besides reading your books and watching the interviews that you've done, which I really enjoyed in preparation for our chat here, I'd recommend that people read your articles on resilience.org. There's some great ones out there. But besides that, Cecile, where else would you like people to connect with you?
Well, you know, I would love to hear from people. Cecile at CecileAndrews.com. That would be great. I would be happy to talk with people. So, you know, I'm always ready to hear what other people are doing, because that's what's exciting, because a lot of people are doing a lot of exciting things, and the more we hear about them from each other, the better. So, yes, I would love to hear from people.
All right. I'll make it easy for people in the show notes to send you an email and to connect with you in a lot of other places. Well, I appreciate our conversation, and I love what you are up to and what you represent. So I have a feeling there might be a follow-up conversation for us in the future.
Oh, good. Good, good. Okay.
Thanks
all
again,
right, thanks.
Cecile.
Bye.
Man, if I keep bringing guests like Cecile on the show, you and I will both be leading a more simple and examined life. I don't know about you, but I'll remember her comments about study circles and how they're supposed to be a barn raising and not a battle. I have a tendency when I get a bit deep to be, shall we say, a little bit too forceful with my ideas. So her comments remind me that I gotta reel it in and I have to pull myself back, that we're trying to build. We're not trying to tear down. Maybe you are going to reflect on how gross national happiness could, should, or will, let's hope will, replace gross domestic product as a country's chief metric. Man, I hope that happens soon. Now, Cecile doesn't do much on social media, so let her know how much you appreciated this episode and what you got out of it in an email to Cecile, that's C-E-C-I-L-E, at cecileandrews.com. As I mentioned a moment ago, I also recommend her articles on resilience.org, which you can find a link to in the show notes, along with Cecile's books and all the other groovy stuff we spoke about. All you have to do is visit valueofsimple.com/SASM055 and voila! I'm also going to put a link in the show notes to another podcast I just started listening to, and I really dig this. It's called Truly Amazing Life, and it's hosted by a dynamite fella named Aaron Kennard. I especially enjoyed episode 37, where Aaron interviews a woman named Daphne Clark Hudson, someone who truly and intensely understands the value of the simple life. You can find more about Aaron and Truly Amazing Life at trulyamazinglife.com. If you want some more of my simple, head on over to simplerev.com. See what me and my partner Dan Hayes have brewing for you. We just finished up what we call our Declaration of Simple Rev and have prominently placed it on the About page. If you like the Value of Simple Declaration, and I hope you do, then you're probably going to love the Simple Rev Declaration. And I want to give an unquantifiably huge shout out to its designer, Sarah Sheets of Peak Team Design, for making it as gorgeous as it is powerful. As always, I would like to hear what's on your mind, but since you haven't invited me to have a relaxing visit in your mind yet, maybe you can get your thoughts out of there and onto the digital page so I know what I should be doing more of, less of, what's working, what's missing the target more than a 12-year-old left-handed third baseman named Joel Zislavsky, and so on. Emails, well, they go to joel@valueofsimple.com. Your tweets, to @JoelZislavsky. Google Plus chatter, that goes to +JoelZislavsky. And everything else to the contact page on Value of Simple. Now, I always dig comments on the show notes, which you can find at valueofsimple.com/SASM055. Or if you're feeling especially nice right now, right now, you can leave some comments in an iTunes review at valueofsimple.com/iTunes. Those reviews, they go a long way to helping other people discover this show and proving that this simplify, organize, and be money-wise thing that we have going on here, it's legit. It's especially legit in a sea of podcasts that are trying to get people to be bigger, faster, stronger, do more, more, more. You and I, we're about slowing down, being intentional, and rocking what we already have. Gratitude, baby. Ooh, there is nothing finer. Now, I'm grateful for you and to you for listening to this episode of the show. Let me welcome back my 3.5-year-old son, Grant, to bring it on home for Papa. Hey, buddy, come on back over here.
This is Grant Zislavsky. Aren't you to simplify, organize, be money-wise?
It's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zislavsky, creator of all things Value of Simple.